Part 3. Connect with others. Chapter 11. Skip the casseroles. In the wake of a major life event, for example, the loss of a loved one or a serious illness, we often receive an outpouring of social support. Coworkers offer assistance. Friends and family step in with an abundance of affection and generosity. Neighbors show up with casseroles. Because such events are typically visible to others, a sufferer's needs become obvious. If someone's house burns down, he clearly requires a place to stay. If someone's parent dies, we send her condolence notes and flowers. The ways to give and receive support are part of customary social behavior. There's little comparable help offered for daily stresses, which may be part of the reason why these hassles take such a toll. Nobody drops off a meatloaf because they heard you had a rough commute. Hugs are not usually available because you forgot your umbrella and got soaked in the rain. Who wants to hug someone who's wet? Friends don't call or text you because they are concerned you couldn't find a parking spot and ended up late for your doctor's appointment. The need for social support and the benefit of positive interactions are less obvious for buffering everyday stress. I meet many people who work hard at doing well at their jobs and invest time and energy into paying attention to deadlines and completing projects. They are conscientious about arriving to meetings on time and returning emails, so much so they think nothing of leaving their significant other sitting in a restaurant waiting while they return an email in the restroom. After a long day being polite to coworkers, they snap at their partner. They make time to return work calls while ignoring one from a friend. What is urgent often eclipses what's important. Our relations with others get sidelined as the demands and challenges of the daily grind grab our attention, drain our energy, and hijack our time. When I went to medical school, there was always more studying to do, always more to learn. Becoming a doctor captured my total focus. I skipped birthdays, baptisms, and weddings. I rarely made time to see friends or family. One year, I even forgot Father's Day. At the same time, I was almost pathologically polite to my patients, teachers, and fellow students. I'd offer an apology to a stranger who stepped on my toe, but was emotionally absent from those to whom I was close. My assumption was that my friends and family would understand and forgive my lack of effort in maintaining our relationships. So when I found out that I hadn't been invited to a friend's small birthday dinner, I got upset at her. I ranted to my sister that this friend had been cruel to cross me off the list. I even remember saying, "I wouldn't have even been able to go, so she really should have invited me." My sister called me on my attitude, asking, "When was the last time you picked up the phone and talked to her?" When I admitted it had been a while, she replied, "What do you expect, Sam? You gotta make an effort. As Nanny always said, the grass is greener where you water it." Social relationships cannot be an afterthought. Happiness comes from with, not within. Sadly, those closest to us are often the first to pay the price when pebbles rain down. Busy schedules, bad moods, fatigue, and mobile devices all contribute to our neglecting the people we care about. What makes matters worse is the widespread belief that mental health is exclusively an individual's responsibility. The motivational thought industry constantly tells us that whatever we want or need is on us to get. Popular slogans that promote this misleading mindset include, "Happiness is an inside job. Everything you need is already within you. You have to find yourself first. Everything else will follow." If you want to be strong, learn how to fight alone. You can't go wrong by making yourself a priority. Instead of empowering us, these mantras weigh us down. As a psychiatrist, one of the greatest challenges I face is trying to persuade patients to focus less on themselves and to cultivate connections with others. Almost every patient wants to be happier, like Suzanne, who literally walked in wearing a t-shirt that insisted, "True happiness comes from within, not from others." On the heels of a breakup with a long-term boyfriend, Suzanne decided she needed to spend more time on herself. Coming to see me was only part of that self-improvement strategy. She also began meditating. She bought a treadmill. She cleaned out her closets and gave away anything that didn't spark joy. Every 2 weeks, she would detox with a juice cleanse. When I asked her how often she saw her friends, she responded, "Not so much these days." She was making herself a priority. The belief that self-centered endeavors are the only way to access well-being is misleading and often harmful. Social relationships cannot be an afterthought. A sense of belonging is not incidental to our positive mental health. It's central. I told Suzanne about a study involving people who were asked, "What can you do so that you will be more satisfied in the future?" Their answers included, "Stop smoking, get a better job, make more money, spend more time with friends and family, and help people." A year later, the researchers checked back in with the study's participants. Responders who described pursuits that involved other people experienced more positive changes and were more satisfied with their lives than those who described non-social strategies. Social engagement trumped personal gain. The study's authors concluded, "Beyond new insights into how people can potentially increase their happiness, our research underscores the crucial role that other people play in our lives. Social relationships and affiliations have powerful effects on health." Loneliness and social isolation have even been associated with increased mortality. Our analysis further strengthened the notion that investments in social relationships are an important leverage point for achieving a healthy, long, and happy life. Similarly, exercise that involves more than one person yields the greatest boost to well-being. People who engage in team sports report having the fewest days of poor mental health each month. Getting physical with others might even help you live longer. According to a study of Danish men and women, tennis players associated with an extra 9.7 years, badminton players 6.2 years, and soccer enthusiasts 5 years enjoy longer lifespans than people who engage in solitary activities such as jogging, 3.2 years, swimming, 3.7 years, or cycling, 3.7 years. Raising your heart rate is good. Raising it with others is even better. Plus, scheduling a workout or walk with a friend reduces the chances of your skipping it. Behavioral scientists call this a commitment device. I call it not wanting to be a flake. I have a standing date to take a walk with a friend on Friday mornings, and without fail, there always comes a moment when the thought crosses my mind to text her that I need to cancel. There are a million reasons I manage to find to skip our meeting. It's too cold, it's too hot, I'm tired, I have a dozen emails to return, I just don't feel like it. But not wanting to be a flake who disappoints a friend gets me out the door every time. By its very nature, the busyness of everyday life draws us into ourselves and away from others. The daily grind invites self-immersion. Hassles promote self-focus. This tends to be corrosive on its own and can be exacerbated by the conviction that well-being is exclusively an internal and individual process. Retreating into oneself and self-focus promote narcissistic behavior, which is the opposite of love and connection. Other people matter. Renowned positive psychologist Christopher Peterson's famous line captures what decades of research have discovered. Deep and meaningful close relationships are at the heart of well-being. Lacking positive relationships is as big a risk factor for early death as smoking cigarettes, alcoholism, obesity, and air pollution. As a society, we value independence and prize self-sufficiency. We celebrate individual achievement and champion personal happiness and success. Positive attributes like motivation, self-control, confidence, and curiosity are assumed to be internally generated. When we speak of resilient people, intrepid individuals who overcame major challenges come to mind. John McCain, Malala Yousafzai, Oprah Winfrey, and Bethany Hamilton. We prize their inner strength and personal fortitude. And when we consider everyday wins or setbacks, we chalk those up to an individual's personal qualities as well. Mary did so well on her exam because of her motivation. Jack can't stick to his diet because he lacks willpower. Jackie gave a great speech because of her confidence. A singular focus on the individual oversimplifies the more nuanced story of what might efficiently and effectively enable someone to reach his or her potential. It is easy to emphasize the power of individual achievement, but the reality is every great success story is the product of a huge network of collaboration. Parents, mentors, teachers, coaches, and a web of supporters all contribute to a person's particular greatness. Even in fields that appear to be dominated by singular greatness, the critical roles that others play are undeniable. In the game of golf, for example, we know the names of the greats: Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, Arnold Palmer. But only a superfan knows the names of their caddies. And yet each caddy is instrumental to the success of the champion golfer. Good caddies function as philosophers, friends, psychologists, and coaches. They are partners who help a player stay focused and build confidence, especially after setbacks like missed putts. Caddies play a key role by helping players to relax under pressure and not overthink their shots. High fives, bear hugs, and a well-timed joke can help a player perform at his or her peak. As professional golfer Johnny Miller observed, "I don't think anywhere is there a symbiotic relationship between caddy and player like there is in golf." To forge connections is a key to attaining success in virtually every profession. In the art world, it has long been held that Johannes Vermeer was a lone genius, but an exhibition at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., dispelled this myth. Vermeer was deeply engaged in an artistic milieu, and his work was fueled and inspired by the exchange of ideas with his peers. Supportive relationships promote personal growth and serve as tailwinds. Psychologists at the University of Michigan found that the more supported people feel, the greater their confidence to take on a challenge. My patient Gina was an entrepreneur who built a wildly popular organic brand. Her former high school wanted to showcase her success and invited her to speak to a graduating class during its commencement. Gina felt honored, yet her first reaction was to reply, "No way. Writing a graduation-worthy speech would take a lot of time and effort, and Gina didn't feel up to it." She went back to the committee and offered, "Why don't I just attend the ceremony and the cocktail party the evening before? That way I can meet students and answer any questions they might have." Gina's husband recognized that she was dismissing an opportunity to reach many more students with her message. He convinced her to meet the challenge, reminding her about the great speech she had given at a conference the year before. He offered to read drafts and to listen to her practice. She finally agreed. Gina's speech was a hit, full of inspiration and humor. She felt thrilled that her husband had encouraged her to push herself. The best relationships serve as sources of strength during tough times. And in the absence of adversity, they also encourage us to embrace, pursue, and fully participate in opportunities that enhance well-being and foster growth. On the surface, people described as go-getters are assumed to possess an abundance of internal qualities that help to spur them on. But the confidence to tackle a challenge and pursue a goal is also generated from sources well beyond the individual. Many tributaries pour into the river that ultimately constitutes the self. With this in mind, in addition to admiring others for their achievements, perhaps we should also thank their parents, friends, partners for offering love and support. Behind every resilient person, there is usually someone who believes in them and has his or her back. Hills less steep to climb. When you feel socially connected, little things are less likely to get under your skin. Studies show that a hill feels less steep to climb when a hiker is accompanied by a friend. Public speaking seems less stressful after a hug from a loved one. A study of paramedics found that even after a high-stress day, such as one in which violence was encountered, a patient was lost or a call was received that involved a child, those who reported high levels of perceived social support slept much better than those who reported low levels. Feeling loved and cared for kept their sleep quality relatively stable despite the challenges of their hectic lives. Another study of married couples proved that the simple gesture of holding a spouse's hand can buffer physical discomfort. Handholding reduced not only the subjective perception of pain, in this experiment, how much an electric shock hurt, but also the brain and the body's physical response to pain. Holding the hand of a stranger was better than to hold no one's hand, but the quality of the relationship mattered. The happiest couples experience the greatest benefits. Knowing you are loved literally lessens pain, lightens the load, and propels you forward up those steep hills. Chapter 12. Gain Some Distance. Who is the real me? In our first session, Kelly described her daily life as crisis surfing and said she had entered therapy to find herself. She'd already begun the process by reading a lot of self-help books and prioritizing self-care. Through self-reflection, she hoped she might finally be able to figure out who she was and what she wanted. And then success, happiness, and fulfillment would follow. When you max out your mental capacity, self-focus can be a form of self-preservation. It is a reflexive response when life feels out of control and everyone seems to want a piece of you. There are also powerful cultural and commercial messages that support this approach, such as those from wealthy, gorgeous celebrities. When you're pelted by the pebbles of everyday life, to focus on the self is a tempting option, but it's not an optimal strategy for feeling better. Self-focus might make you feel less vulnerable, but it can also seal you off from vitality, spiraling inward, going over what is bothering you again and again with a fine-tooth comb, scrutinizing every little detail of what has happened or might happen can play a role in the onset and maintenance of depression. Instead of self-immersing, put some space between you and whatever is bothering you. Self-distancing helps to take the sting out of everyday upsetting events. Failures and setbacks seem less personal. Self-distancing can even help you to better manage anxiety about future worries, such as failing an exam or getting sick. Establishing mental separation from an emotional situation gets the ego out of the way, provides perspective, and makes it easier to move forward. It can also decrease rumination. The word rumination comes from the Latin term ruminare and means to chew cud, partially digested food that is regurgitated from the stomach for another round of chewing. In fact, the first stomach compartment of ruminants, cattle, deer, giraffes, is known as the rumen. When we ruminate, we are mentally chewing partially digested thoughts. Participants in one study were asked to recall an intense negative experience and then to adopt either a self-immersed or a self-distanced perspective. The self-immersed group were given one set of instructions. Go back to the time and place of the experience you just recalled and see the scene in your mind's eye. Now, see the experience unfold through your own eyes as if it were happening to you all over again. Replay the event as it unfolds in your imagination through your own eyes. The self-distanced group were given a separate set of instructions. Go back to the time and place of the experience you just recalled and see the scene in your mind's eye. Now, take a few steps back. Move away from the situation to a point where you can now watch the event unfold from a distance and see yourself in the event. As you do this, focus on what has now become the distant you. Now watch the experience unfold as if it were happening to the distant you all over again. Replay the event as it unfolds in your imagination as you observe your distant self. Both groups were then asked to analyze their feelings about the experience. The participants who were cued to analyze their feelings from a distance focused less on recounting the emotionally charged features of the negative experience and more on reconstruing it in a productive way that gave them insight and closure. With distance, they didn't just rehash what happened to them, they processed it. One self-distancer wrote, "I was able to see the argument more clearly. I initially empathized better with myself, but then I began to understand how my friend felt. Those feelings may have been irrational, but I could understand his motivation." This response reflects a desire to move on as the self-distancer replaces the pain surrounding the argument with understanding, which allows her to feel more empathy. Compare this with the raw and agonizing response of a participant who was asked to analyze her feelings about a negative experience from a self-immersed perspective. Adrenaline infused, pissed off, betrayed, angry, victimized, hurt, shamed, stepped on, shitted on, humiliated, abandoned, unappreciated, pushed, boundaries trampled upon. Immersing yourself in your feelings does not necessarily facilitate insight or understanding. It can actually get you stuck. When you step outside of yourself, it is easier to understand opposing viewpoints and appreciate subtlety. Issues are less black and white. A bit of distance can help you make better decisions and manage negative feelings more adroitly. Immersing yourself in your inner thoughts narrows the lens through which you view the world. Think of a horse putting on blinders. That perspective may be ideal for barreling ahead, but terrible for viewing the entire landscape. Frequently discussing and speculating about yourself and rehashing your problems can increase distress and undermine resilience. Let's say you're having a conflict with a coworker. When self-immersed, you're more likely to jump to a superficial explanation for the disagreement. You might simply dismiss your colleague as an idiot. If you're self-distancing, you'll gain the perspective of the entire landscape and be able to identify where your views actually diverged. You might still conclude your coworker is annoying as hell, but it won't feel as personal. When you are self-immersed, it is more difficult to be cool-headed and put negative issues aside. Similar to having a sportscaster in your head providing play-by-play commentary, every annoyance and irritation tends to grab your attention. A literal chain of frustrating events. My dog threw up on the carpet this morning, then my 5-year-old stepped in it, wearing his brand new shoes we had bought for my cousin's upcoming wedding that I didn't even want to go to, and then he walked on our brand new carpet, and then adds up and amplifies the accompanying negative emotions. Brooding makes it hard to concentrate on anything else. Your mood takes a nosedive. Anger bubbles to the surface. The experience of fatigue or any bodily aches and pains that might otherwise have gone unnoticed is now a constant. Taking an outsider's point of view can provide insight and reduce negative feelings about setbacks and conflicts from the past. Self-distancing also has application in everyday life. On those days when everything seems to be going wrong and you are convinced that the world is conspiring against you, remember, it's probably not. When you take everything personally, the endless red traffic light, the 5 people who get into the elevator with you and press every floor below yours, emotional stamina is depleted. Stepping outside of yourself can help reduce irritation and anger in the moment. A patient of mine is a huge Elvis Costello fan. When he'd feel irritation mounting, he'd start to sing to himself the lyrics from the song Red Shoes. I used to be disgusted, but now I try to be amused. In a study, flies on the wall are less aggressive. Researchers intentionally provoked participants by interrupting and berating them for not following directions. Those who were instructed to view the takedown from an emotional distance exhibited less anger than those who immersed themselves in their emotions. The worst thing to do in an anger-inducing situation is what people normally do. Try to focus on their hurt and angry feelings to understand them. It keeps the aggressive thoughts and feelings active in your mind, which makes it more likely that you'll act aggressively, explained the co-author of the study. Self-distancing isn't just good for you, it's good for your relationships. Going beyond our own issues helps us get along better with others. There are so many opportunities to use self-distancing to stop us from ruminating about something that happened in the past, to provide perspective in the moment, and to quell worries about the future. Time travel. Another way to disrupt rumination is to time travel. Imagining what your future self might think about a current stressor has been shown to reduce the emotional toll of the present. For example, as upsetting as an interaction with that annoying coworker might be today, fast forwarding from the current situation to a year in the future might help you take it less personally and see it as less permanent. Recognizing the transitory nature of a hassle can reduce the distress you feel about it. Projecting into the future can also help people overcome relationship conflicts. Participants in a study were asked to think about a recent conflict with a partner or close friend. The experimental group was asked to consider how they would feel about the conflict a year later. The control group was asked to describe how they were feeling currently. The researchers found that those who considered the conflict from a future perspective showed more forgiveness and greater insight. They also reported feeling more positively about their relationship. This strategy worked wonders with my patient, Kiara, who had trouble letting go of grievances. She had an uncanny ability to remember the specifics of any argument, slight, or disappointment, and cataloged them like a librarian trained in the Dewey Decimal classification system, so they were ready to be recalled at a moment's notice. I could see her visibly tense up when she spoke about them, ensnared in a web of overwhelming emotion. Adopting a future perspective enabled her to view these moments without all the messiness. "It's like I had the windows cleaned," she explained. "No more grime in the corners, and I can see out perfectly." Talk to yourself. Changing how you talk to yourself is another way to stop yourself from tumbling down the rabbit hole of relentless self-focus. Before you roll your eyes, let me make it clear that I am not suggesting talking to yourself out loud, nor do I endorse referring to yourself in conversation in the third person, such as in "Samantha prefers her pasta al dente." But there is evidence that using your name in third-person pronouns, such as he, she, it, itself, they, them, to refer to yourself in silent introspection during a stressful moment can enhance your ability to control your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. For example, participants in a study were told they had to deliver an important speech about why they were ideally qualified to land their dream job. They had just 5 minutes to prepare it. As you can imagine, it made for a stressful situation. When the 5 minutes were up, half were asked to reflect on their anxiety using non-first-person pronouns or their name. For example, "Is Samantha going to give a good speech?" The other half were asked to reflect using first-person pronouns. "Am I going to give a good speech?" Next, each participant was asked to deliver his or her speech in front of a panel of evaluators. The speeches were also recorded and shown to judges who knew nothing about the conditions of the experiment or the instructions the participants had received. The participants who had been asked to reflect on their anxiety using non-first-person pronouns were judged to be more confident, less nervous, and better overall than those in the first-person group. Moreover, participants in the non-first-person group said they felt less embarrassed and reported ruminating less about their performance afterward. A patient with social anxiety realized that whenever she spoke to herself using "I," she became hypercritical and riddled with doubt. Like the Chiron at the bottom of television news channels, her inner voice relentlessly informed her, "I'm not up to this. What's wrong with me? I'm so awkward. I should just go home." I encouraged her to try speaking to herself in the third person to see if that perspective shift led to a healthier inner dialogue. Instead of opting for Kiara, though, she chose a new name for addressing herself, Wonder Woman. She told me that when thrown into anxiety-provoking social and professional situations, meeting friends at a bar, the morning of a conference, before an interview, she would look in a mirror and say, "Hey, Wonder Woman, you got this." This story delighted me. She not only shut down her self-loathing voice, she boosted her confidence. What would you tell a friend? Many of us are good at offering sage advice to others, but when it comes to our own personal dilemmas, we're useless. This disconnect actually has a name, Solomon's Paradox, after the king of ancient Israel, King Solomon, who was known for his wisdom. His subjects traveled far and wide to seek his advice, but in his personal life, the king was a hot mess. Granted, it's hard to juggle hundreds of wives, especially when you add in concubines too. Still, King Solomon's biggest failure was as a father. He had only one son, who grew up to be an incompetent ruler, which led to the kingdom's downfall. When we are locked in our thoughts, it's harder to see the long view. We are more likely to focus on the minutiae and the immediate consequences, and less likely to consider the broader ramifications of our actions or to be aware of our biases. Self-interest can involve more than putting up blinders. It can be blinding. Considering how you would advise a friend in a similar situation can help you make a better decision for yourself. When you make a problem less about you, you ultimately see more. Research shows that decentering, shifting the focus away from yourself and towards someone else, promotes more effective conflict resolution and more effective reasoning about personal issues. Decentering is also linked with cultivating greater humility and an awareness of one's own shortcomings, and with feeling greater appreciation for another person's point of view. I often encourage patients to use self-distancing when talking or thinking about something that upset them in the past, and to deploy these strategies to deal with everyday challenges. I also urge them to be mindful about how they speak about their problems with their friends. A patient who had a difficult relationship with her mother-in-law would spend hours rehashing the latest incident or insult with her best friend and speculating about what her monster-in-law might do next. It was their go-to conversation, or as my patient called it, a bitch fest. Afterward, she would often feel even angrier. Venting can feel great in the moment, but doing so repeatedly without any resolution or forward progress can make you feel worse. Excessive complaining and rehashing personal problems with someone else is known as co-rumination and can amplify stress, especially in those who are already feeling down. If your best friend calls you to talk about something that's bothering her, it is best to avoid questions that encourage her to revisit every detail. Start from the beginning, tell me everything, will only lead to a play-by-play of what took place and what she was feeling. Consider instead posing a question that might help your friend gain some distance from the situation. I often ask my patients, if someone else were in this situation, what advice would you give them? Rather than dwelling on the details, help others generate a plan of action. It is natural for parents to want to know what's going on in an adolescent's head. But a parent who fixates on what's going wrong might do a child more harm than good. In a study of 400 students, 5th, 8th, and 11th graders, researchers found that adolescents who co-ruminated with their mothers were more likely to co-ruminate with their friends and to become anxious and depressed as a result. Circular conversations about negative feelings without resolution fuel worry and feelings of sadness and can lead to indecision. Undergraduates who co-ruminated with their parents were more likely to suffer from anxiety. It is likely that co-rumination fosters the unhealthy tendency to ruminate on one's own. My patient Helena told me that when she was a child, her mother would read the newspaper every morning at breakfast, and whenever she came upon a criminal or tragic story, she would gasp and read the full story aloud, dramatizing the goriest details. "Listen to this," she would say. "Oh, it's just awful. Can you imagine? An entire family wiped out in a fire? How horrendous." When Helena's father entered the kitchen, there was a repeat performance. And that wasn't the end of it. If her mother bumped into a friend at the bus stop, she would bring the story up again. "Did you hear about that awful fire?" Rumination was this woman's way of bonding with people, including her daughter. She recalled how the two of them would sit together in the car on the way to school, rehashing complaints, mulling over grievances. Commiserating with her mom created a fleeting feeling of closeness, but didn't teach Helena how to manage discomfort or face a challenge. As an adult, Helena adopted a similar appetite for conversations that dwelled on misery. Eventually, she realized how co-ruminating left everyone involved stuck in an emotional sinkhole without a way out. These discussions created pseudo-bonding, eliciting emotion that was superficial and disconnected to people's actual lives. Helena eventually realized that whenever conversation began to feel as if she had had it before, it was a sign for her to change the subject. It's remarkable how easily one person's conversational style can rub off on another. The results of one study indicated that a short chat with a ruminating stranger can induce rumination, even in someone who doesn't typically ruminate. For better or for worse, we mirror the behavior of the people around us. And when it comes to ruminating, it is definitely for worse. If the person sitting next to you on a long flight breaks the ice by asking, "Do you ever wish you had made different choices in your life?" steer the conversation in another direction or put on your headphones. Something bigger than you. If your teenager is upset about something, asking her to recount every little detail to you and perhaps later to your partner, "Tell your stepmom exactly what happened today at school," could make her feel even worse. Turning every problem into an ongoing centerpiece of conversation can ultimately undermine resilience. You might be sending the inadvertent message that the issue is worse or more serious than it is, or that you believe your child can't handle the situation. If that child had an issue with Johnny today, don't let the first question you ask after school tomorrow be, "Was Johnny mean to you again today?" If you don't let it go, your child won't either. When listening to your adolescent, stay calm, express empathy, and encourage them to consider the situation from alternate perspectives. These are more effective methods for working out problems than mining for pain and dwelling on anger. Instead of making a teenager's problems the go-to conversation, consider that kids who know a lot about their family history, where their grandmother went to school, where their great uncle grew up, how and when their parents met, and so on, have been shown to be more confident and resilient overall than those who don't. Researchers theorize that helping children develop a strong, intergenerational self reminds them that they belong to something bigger than themselves. They are not the central character in the family story, but part of a chapter that is still being written. It is the opposite of all about me, and as such has a valuable decentering effect. Knowing that the family made it through challenging times in the past, that its story continues to unfold, makes the setbacks adolescents encounter feel less daunting. Rudyard Kipling captures this perspective perfectly in his poem, If. When you know the arc of your family narrative, you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. When you are wrapped up in yourself, it is more difficult to spot or capitalize on what exists beyond you. It is harder to accept another person's perspective, and uplifts are scarcer. Apprehension, pressure, tension, worry, and the dread of what's next draw us into ourselves. There are many reasons why people engage in resilient sapping behavior. It is reflexive. It is what others are doing. It is momentarily self-soothing. But there are more healthy responses to distress. We can get closer to vitality by gaining some distance from ourselves. Chapter 13, Tailwinds. Human beings are made up of each other. We are deeply social creatures. Our bodies constrain us, but our social interactions make us who we are. Tanya Lerman. When I ask patients to tell me about their day, they inevitably speak about the people in their lives. They open up about their exhausting but wonderful kids, their narcissistic colleagues, their hard-to-read boyfriends, their hot and cold mothers-in-law, their hard-to-please teachers, their always-there-for-them friends, their adoring but needy grandparents, their life-saving babysitters, and their entitled bosses. Positive, uplifting interactions are often considered the best part of a day. We are grateful to the person who made us laugh. We cherish a sweet text from a loved one or compliment from a coworker. Even a random interaction with a stranger, a barista, a salesperson, someone in line at the post office can make the list of a day's highlights. Likewise, negative interactions are a significant source of everyday distress. It is no surprise that an argument is one of the most upsetting of daily aggravations. A harsh exchange in the morning can cast a shadow over the rest of the day. An unpleasant conversation with a colleague or even a stranger can leave one feeling ill at ease. Our interactions with others and the emotions they uncover reveal a lot about who we are. Transference is a concept first introduced by Freud in his book Studies on Hysteria. Transference occurs when feelings about one person are redirected toward another. Noting the deep and intense feelings that patients developed toward him in therapy, Freud postulated that the patients were unconsciously projecting their feelings about important people in their lives on him. I'm not a Freudian analyst, but I'm deeply interested in my patients' interactions with the important people in their lives, as well as the seemingly minor ones. One patient in her late 40s, Zara, spoke at length to me about a jerk who didn't hold the elevator for her on the way to my office. This small act unleashed a stockpile of anger and triggered my patient's anxiety about feeling invisible. She took the slight personally, convinced the man would have held the elevator if she'd been a beautiful 20-year-old. I asked her what I often ask patients to challenge their certitude. Is there an alternative explanation? It is certainly possible the man would have only held the door if she'd been a supermodel, but it was also possible he was late for an appointment and in a rush, just like her. We often look for evidence that reinforces our beliefs and confirms our fears. Any ambiguous situation can serve to strengthen our convictions. When the elevator door diss happened, Zara was already dreading an upcoming birthday after reading an article that claimed a woman is most beautiful at the age of 36. From then on, she half-joked, it's all downhill. Zara was concerned about growing older, but vanity wasn't the issue. As we talked more, it became clear that she was afraid her husband would leave her for a younger woman. Zara had witnessed this dynamic in her parents' marriage when her father left her mother at age 45 for his young secretary. Zara rolled her eyes at how cliched the situation was, but it haunted her. While she sympathized with her mom, she also blamed her for not trying harder to hold her father's interest. Zara acknowledged that during the past few months, she had become increasingly cold and distant with her own husband. Her brief encounter with an impatient man unearthed her conviction that it was inevitable she would repeat her parents' history and it would all be her fault. Surfacing this fear enabled her to address it directly. I spend a lot of time talking with patients about everyday encounters, the good, the bad, the ones they wished they had, the ones they intentionally avoided, and even the ones they may not have even realized they missed. It is not that patients don't value their connections. They do, but the daily grind gets in the way. They forget to make the effort to connect. Positive relationships support individuals not only in their ability to cope with stress and adversity, but also in their efforts to learn, grow, and explore. Simply put, they are a reservoir of vitality. Given the benefits of meaningful relationships in one's life, it's worth taking a closer look at what actually constitutes a good one. In an influential study, The Need to Belong, social psychologists explored the nature of social connections and the underpinnings of lasting and meaningful bonds with others. Their findings showed that a critical aspect of any healthy and fulfilling relationship is to have frequent, positive interactions. This means, for example, that being in the same room is not enough if everyone in the family keeps his nose in a screen. In the context of friendship, liking a friend's Instagram post, retweeting her tweet, and sending a group email wishing everyone on your contact list a Happy New Year doesn't count. They're low-effort connections that offer a low emotional payoff. You can have many daily interactions with people and still feel lonely. A bond in name only lacks the mental and physical health benefits of a high-quality connection. When interactions are ridden with conflict and contempt, or if they feel empty and devoid of care and concern, then it's a relationship, but not a satisfying one. One patient tells me she sometimes has to text her boyfriend to get his attention, even when he's sitting right next to her. In fact, 2 in 5 Americans sometimes or always feel their relationships are not meaningful. Having social connections does not necessarily mean you feel connected. Feeling cared for, appreciated, and understood are necessary for a sense of belonging. It is often the subtle behaviors rooted in the daily fabric of relationships that communicate a genuine sense of love. Married couples who lived apart, such as so-called commuter couples, revealed it was the little things they missed most about living together. Those seemingly trivial moments, like sipping coffee together in the morning or watching Jeopardy together in the evening. Frequent long-distance phone conversations helped but didn't make up for the lack of day-to-day interactions. Sharing information and discussing practical issues didn't produce the same pleasant feelings associated with enjoying each other's company. One might assume the main reason commuter couples are less happy than those who live together is that they have less sex. The evidence suggests otherwise. Most of the commuter couples in the study typically had sex only during weekends, even during the times when they lived together, which is consistent with surveys of cohabiting married couples. So being apart during the week was unlikely to impact their sex life. Beyond sex, there is something about being together both emotionally and physically that is necessary to satisfy the need to belong. It is in the warmth, the eye contact, the hand on the shoulder, the warm hug, the peck on the cheek. Indeed, such insubstantial interactions turn out to be quite substantial. According to the UK campaign to end loneliness, more than half of lonely people simply miss having someone to laugh with. It is the simple, everyday activities, such as sharing a meal, getting a hug, holding hands, and taking country walks that people long for. Simple, everyday, positive interactions are the lifeblood of companionship and connection. There is some evidence that these interactions are more valuable than overt gestures of support or concern. I had a well-intentioned friend who would always make assumptions about my well-being. Whenever we saw each other, she would offer support with just a tad too much concern. Is everything okay? Be honest, are you really okay? You look tired. I'm going to get you a kombucha ginger shot to help you combat that cold you're probably coming down with, she said with furrowed brow. I actually felt fine until she commented on my bedraggled appearance. Then I couldn't think of anything else. Do I look that bad? Is it time to pound kombucha? Maybe I'm sick? Support can do more harm than good when it's out of sync with another person's needs. Before you voice concern or offer help, take into account how it might impact the person on the receiving end. Sharing unsolicited advice can inadvertently make them feel inadequate or incompetent. Think of the parent who swoops in to help with the child's math homework before the child even asks a question. Being over-involved can undermine someone's confidence. Be responsive to the person in a way that helps them feel understood and validated, and that shows you care with or without kombucha. Invisible support. Unlike heavy-handed gestures, the most effective kind of support is often invisible to the recipient. For example, you might shield your partner from having to worry about a broken dishwasher by managing the repair process yourself. You might tidy up so that your partner comes home to a calm and peaceful apartment. If a partner has a long day and needs to use the car first thing in the morning, you can make sure that it has a full tank of gas. If your partner's boss sends a weekend email asking for a meeting first thing Monday morning, framing that as a positive can shape whether your partner views the message as a threat or an opportunity. If a school friend is worried about an upcoming math test, you could ask the teacher to hold a study session for the entire class. Using a daily diary, law students preparing to take the New York State Bar Examination were asked to record their experiences of receiving emotional support from their partners in the weeks leading up to the exam. Their partners were also asked to record acts of providing support to the student. The students who received invisible support, support that was not obvious to them, experienced less anxiety and stress than those who received more overt support. It seems that the most effective kind of support takes place without drawing attention to the recipient's specific needs. It is possible that providing invisible support is the essence of being a good parent, mentor, friend, partner, and doctor. Micro moments of thoughtfulness are the secret sauce of robust relationships and contribute to feelings of connection and greater well-being. The reason people with strong social ties are healthier and feel happier and more vital is not because they are more likely to ask for and receive support whenever they feel the least bit of tension, but because their loved ones are more likely to enhance their lives in countless subtle ways. Communicate your affection. Flowers and chocolates are nice, but it's the implicit communication of affection that makes a person feel loved. Responsiveness is essential for expressing that affection. It's a bedrock of intimacy. Responsiveness entails consistently showing another person that they are genuinely understood, valued, and cared about every single day. Tender behavior leads to high-quality interactions that increase love and passion in both the short and long term. During the beginning of a relationship, couples cannot keep their hands off of each other. Romance and sexual desire take center stage. Then, over time, that first blush of passion fades. The assumption is that desire diminishes as familiarity and intimacy set in. This is known as the intimacy-desire paradox. The paradox is predicated on the belief that desire is driven by uncertainty and novelty. So the more emotionally connected people are, the less desire they feel for each other. But a study conducted in Israel has called the intimacy-desire paradox into question. The research shows sexual desire actually thrives with rising intimacy. Being responsive is one of the best ways to instill this elusive sensation over time, wrote researcher Gerrit Birnbaum. It's better than any pyrotechnic sex. Behaving thoughtfully and making an effort with each other fuels sexual desire, especially for women, although men report a boost too. Bringing home her favorite ice cream, taking turns choosing movies, deciding to read the same book, and sending him a flirty text are among the many ways you can be responsive. Of course, not all intimacy is created equal. Brushing your teeth together, leaving the bathroom door open, and clipping your toenails in front of your partner might not fan the fires of desire. As the saying goes, if you act like you did at the beginning of the relationship, there wouldn't be an end. When there are kids to feed, bills to pay, and laundry to do, being nice doesn't always come easily. Taryn realized she was taking out her frustrations from her long work days as an emergency room doctor on her partner and kids when she got home. "I storm into the house, pointing fingers and barking orders. Julian, get in the shower, now. Ethan, why aren't you studying for your history test? Why hasn't anyone walked the dogs? Do I have to do everything around here?" Because of the way Taryn issued such commands, her husband and kids started to refer to her as Stormin' Norman after U.S. General Norman Schwarzkopf Jr. On her arrival home, she and her husband would begin bickering, the kids would start fighting, and even the dogs would get riled up. In therapy, Taryn recognized that her husband wasn't thoughtless, as she accused him of being, and that her kids weren't the ingrates she complained about. The actual issue was that pent-up frustrations from the day were infecting her evenings at home. We discussed creating a decontamination protocol to help her wash off the negative residue of the day. I told Taryn about a high school English teacher who would sit in her car for 15 minutes and listen to heavy metal music to decompress. I knew this tactic wasn't going to work for her, but it sparked a few ideas, such as instead of scrolling through work emails on the train on the way home, Taryn decided to read a novel. She got off the subway a stop earlier so she had more time to walk off the negative energy. And she channeled a scene from the movie Outbreak. The moment Taryn got home, she changed out of her work clothes and into soft sweatpants. I also encouraged Taryn to devise ways to manage stress more effectively at work so it wouldn't take such a toll at the end of the day. She had always considered taking breaks a waste of time, but discovered they actually made her more productive. Her kids came up with a third idea. They took her phone and changed her screensaver to an image of General Schwarzkopf. Though he was a fine commander, they explained, they didn't like it when their mom morphed into him. The image on Taryn's phone made her smile. Laughing at yourself is always good medicine. How happy couples argue. When I was younger, I assumed that people in happy relationships rarely fought. During my early years of clinical training, I asked an elderly patient, Margaret, who had been happily married for over 50 years, how she and her husband avoided conflict. "Are you joking?" she asked, howling with laughter. "We argue all the time." It turns out that happy couples have disagreements, just like everyone else. What's different is how they fight. Even when we agree to disagree, I always feel like he tries to take my perspective and sees the situation from my side, Margaret explained. Again, responsiveness is key. Sensing that your romantic partner is trying to understand where you're coming from and respects your point of view helps to protect a relationship from the potentially harmful effects of conflict and can even strengthen your bond. When happy couples argue, they stay on topic, steering clear of generalizations like, "Here you go again." Insulting extended family, especially mothers-in-law, is a definite no-no. Why questions, as in, "Why are you so upset?" are also to be avoided because they invite blame and defensiveness. Asking a what question, as in, "What's on your mind?" is less confrontational. Happy couples also know how to pick and choose. Instead of dwelling on issues that aren't easily changed, like one's partner's snoring or an in-law's sarcasm, they focus on problems that are more easily resolved. Margaret told me she always selected her battles wisely. You can argue about every little thing until the cows come home. But what's the point? If it's not solvable, we don't bother. It is important to show your partner you're interested in what he or she is saying when you argue. It is even more important to demonstrate interest when they share good news, according to Shelley Gable of UC Santa Barbara. For instance, imagine Maria comes home from her job as an associate at a law firm and excitedly tells her husband she has been assigned to be the lead lawyer on a big case. He could respond in a number of ways, including 1, with wholehearted enthusiasm. Wow, that's awesome. What's the case about? Your hard work is really paying off. I'm so excited for you. Tell me more. 2, like a distracted robot. Cool, he mutters while checking email. 3, rain on the parade. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of work. Do you think no one else wanted the case? 4, hijack the conversation. Guess what happened to me today? Wholehearted enthusiasm is known as active, constructive responding, or ACR. And it's the only style associated with higher relationship quality and greater personal well-being. Expressing interest and support brings couples closer and enhances connection, while the other 3 styles are all negatively associated with relationship quality. Active constructive responding benefits all types of relationships, including with friends, students, coworkers, and children. Listen carefully the next time someone you care about reports something good that has happened. It may be as simple as they're showing you an article in a newspaper that interests them or telling you about a book they just finished. Give this person your full attention. Look up from your phone. Ask questions. Relive the moment with them. If you're at a loss for words, just remember these 3. Tell me more. Of all the research I learned about while studying positive psychology, Gable's work had the most immediate impact on my everyday life. I cringed when I first encountered it. Although I didn't hijack conversations to make them all about me, I was definitely guilty at times of being a distracted robot, barely grunting acknowledgement when my husband tried to tell me something. Can't he see I'm busy? Without intending to, I sometimes rained on my kids' parade. Once my daughter excitedly told me she wanted to join the basketball team. Okay, I responded. I just hope it doesn't interfere with your schoolwork. When are the games? Are you sure it's a good idea? I wasn't just raining. I was thunderstorming. After reading Gable's research, I made the conscious decision to become an active, constructive responder. It doesn't always come naturally. On a recent evening, my husband mentioned he had seen a fantastic exhibition of a well-known artist's late works. Really? I was about to reply. I haven't heard the best things about it. Instead, I bit my tongue and said, "Tell me more." Responsiveness is a catalyst for felt love. It is well established that positive emotions promote health and well-being in individuals. Shared ones are even more powerful. Make the most of them.